Welcome, where business buying banter meets no BS reality. Get ready to dive into the world of buying and selling businesses without the fluff and fancy jargon. Whether you're a seasoned business buying pro or a curious aspiring entrepreneur, this is where the real talk happens. Because in business, there's no room for sugarcoating. Let's get down to the brass tacks.
Happy day.
Happy day.
Happy days are here again. Remember that
okay.
song?
Yeah. Happy you can sing a few bars.
Happy days are here again. The skies or something. I don't know. Do you help me out with the lyrics on that one?
No, I could just hum along.
It's good to see you, Richard. Making me smile.
Always a pleasure. How you doing?
On a Thursday. I'm doing good. Excited for today's topic. Which is the right business for you.
Yes, I can't wait for this. This is it. This is everything. This is, this is sort of what I've been teaching and preaching for decades and it's just so important. So I'm looking to diving right in.
Yeah. I thought we would kick it off because I was thinking, how should we kick it off? I always think of business buyers when they call a lender or call a broker or call you or I, they tell us the business, how they look at what they perceive as the right business for them. So what are some good ones that you have heard along the years?
Well, I got lots of them. So, I just want to take a step back for a second to the point that you're saying, because one of the biggest problems is prospective business buyers have this horrific misconception of what constitutes the right business. And where they miss the mark repeatedly is the right business is a business that's right for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have a good business and it's run by the wrong person, it's going to go south quickly. Similarly, there's lots of businesses out there that are just not run by good owners. And, we outline 23 steps in the business buying process, which there are from what to consider right through to closing the deal and then post-purchase priorities. And of those steps, if you were to do a marginal job on all of them, including the valuation, negotiation, due diligence, investigating the competition, et cetera, and what the industry looks like, if you were to do an okay job on all of them, but you do a terrific job on identifying what type of business is right for you and match it perfectly to the appropriate business, you are going to be fine. But if you do it the other way around, if you do a flawless job of everything in the process, but you don't get the business that's right for you,
mm-hmm.
it's probably going to go out of business pretty quickly. And yeah. So the making sure that you acquire a business that's specifically geared for your best skill set mm-hmm. is critical, is absolutely critical. It's everything.
Yes. Thank you. One of the most common phrases I hear from many business buyers out there is they're looking for a business that has this much EBITDA.
Yep.
And where do we go wrong there, Richard? I mean, where do buyers go wrong there? This much EBITDA.
Well, the obvious thing is, the money's important, the profit's important, the cash flow is important, all of that is important. But again, if the business has this much EBITDA, or I'm looking for business with this much EBITDA, well, if you're the wrong person to run it, guess what? If we have this conversation in 6 months from now, it's going to be this much EBITDA less a whole lot of EBITDA.
There you go.
Right. And then also, I know that like on the lender side, like having relevant industry experience is obviously really important.
Yeah. Can you explain, which I could as well, but EBITDA, what it stands for our listeners? So that's a common acronym that we hear, but not everybody lives in our world of acronyms. So give it to us, Richard. EBITDA.
Okay. So I know Sia has a comment there, but it's EBITDA, EBITDA, which is the textbook term. The definition is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And in the real world of layman's terms, it's as follows. It's a debt-free managed business.
There we go.
That's what it is. That's EBIT. EBITDA. EBIT is a business, including the interest and depreciation or depreciation amortization costs, and that's really what operating income looks like. But to keep it in real simple terms, is it's a managed debt-free business. Mm-hmm. Also, what you have is you have this wealth of terms in the business for sale world that are allegedly supposed to mean the same thing: owner's benefit, adjusted earnings, adjusted EBITDA, seller's discretionary earnings, etc. They're supposed to, what they're all supposed to mean is the following, because they're different than EBITDA, is the net income of the business on the tax return, plus adding back owner's salary, plus perks, any one-time expenses, interest and depreciation, and then offsetting it, which mm-hmm. most brokers forget to, no, I don't know if they forget, but leave it alone not to do it. But you have to, if there's a depreciation add back, you have to offset that with a capital allowance, a capital expenditure allowance to accommodate future asset purchases, if you will. So getting back to EBITDA, simple terms, debt-free managed business.
And would it be correct to say EBITDA on different industries is a different definition?
Nope. The definition is the same because it's a formula. Mm-hmm. The percentages may change according to industry. So for example, one type of industry may across the board typically have a 10% EBITDA, while another one might have 20 or 2. But the definition of EBITDA is a textbook accounting term. There's no wavering on that. It's where buyers of the smaller businesses run into trouble is when there's representation by a seller or an intermediary of here's what the owner's benefit or seller's discretionary earnings or adjusted EBITDA, because sometimes they take the EBITDA number and make the adjustments to it to try to equal owner's benefit or what have you. Mm-hmm. And so the most important thing that a buyer needs to do is you can get all wrapped up in all of these terms, but what a buyer needs to do is the following. Hey, Mr. or Mrs. Seller or Broker, mm-hmm. break down for me exactly what's in that number.
That's right. That's right. And these buyers that are, you know, coming to a lender, coming to me for financing, saying, I only want businesses that have this much EBITDA. Well, that's not necessarily the answer. That means that is the business fit for you. It can have all the EBITDA in the world, but it may not be the right business fit for you.
Exactly. You're spot on. It's exactly what I was mentioning mm-hmm. earlier. And that's critically important. And another area where, you know, along the subject lines of what is the right business for you. And so there's a couple things. The mantra that I've been teaching and preaching for decades is the following: whatever it is that you do best must be the single most important driving factor of the revenue and profits of any business you consider purchasing. That's it. That's mm-hmm. a nutshell. They get that right and you're halfway home. Amen. Another area where I see buyers sort of go off the reservation is confusing experience with expertise. Mm-hmm. In other words, just because you've worked in a certain industry, mm-hmm. well, that gives you experience in an industry, but it doesn't make you an expert at a specific skill. What you want to drill down to is what is it that I did or do in any jobs that are my single greatest skill set? Because everybody has a shining star. Everybody mm-hmm. has one thing that they're absolutely terrific at, you know? Yeah. And so that is what you need to drill down to. And sometimes you need to speak to colleagues or coworkers or former bosses mm-hmm. and get their input, because not people often what they think they're good at is not necessarily what they're really good at. And it has a tendency to be more what they enjoy or what they think they're going to enjoy. And you can't, those are all confusing things. You've got to drill down to your skill set, your single biggest shining star skill. That's what you have to identify and marry it to a business that needs that to grow and generate revenue.
I love that. And I'm going to follow up your sage statements there with an example for our listeners.
Great.
Auto repair industry. Sometimes buyers will come to the table and they have the experience under the hood, repairing the car, taking care of the repairs that are needed. They have the experience. They're the technician and they want to buy the business, but they don't have any experience in sales, in marketing, in customer service, people skills, right? You don't have a lot of people skills when your head is under the hood. So I'd like to share with our listeners that there is confusion out in the marketplace that if you want to buy an established, proven, profitable auto repair shop, that you have to be a licensed mechanic. That is not true. I have financed buyers that were the general manager of an auto repair shop, and she did the inventory. She handled the customer service. She hired the technicians. She kept everybody happy. If she left the building, the mechanics would not know how to run that business. So think, who would be the better fit for that business? Now we got to be careful because some states require an owner to have a license to be an auto repair technician, you know, state by state specific. But let's think back to what Richard said, your expertise. And yeah, maybe some shops, deals may need a licensed mechanic to be owner if it's state specific. But there are many deals where someone that has people skills, because if you don't have people skills, you're not going to be successful because people bring profit. And I just wanted to add that, Richard.
No, it's so important because it's a perfect example. In that particular case, someone from looking from the outside would say, hey, you know, and if I want to identify the driver of this business, and when I say driver, it's what drives the revenue and profits of the business, it would be very easy for them to look at it and say, it's the caliber of work that gets done under the hood. Well, the reality is you can always hire good auto technicians. They may be hard to come across, but they are available. And certainly if you've got them, you want to take care of them. In that particular business, what drives the business is the customer interface, managing the inventory, making sure the parts are ordered to complete the job so you get paid. Mm-hmm. And so the operations person, whether it be, you know, an extension that sales, marketing, customer service, but operationally, that's the individual that's needed to drive the revenue and profits in that particular business. So it's to the point we talked about earlier. This is so important. I mean, I can't even emphasize it enough how critical this is to the process. You've got to get this part right, and why business buyers end up not closing transactions in the numbers that they fail, because we've talked about that before, how pathetic the numbers are, mm-hmm. is they jump into this process, they start racing around the internet, looking at businesses for sale, clicking all over the place, yeah. sometimes sending an inquiry, looking at one business after another, trying to figure out which, if any, is right for them. And that's ass backwards. You've got mm-hmm. to do this in a way. You first have to figure out what type of business is right for you. And you can do that with a little bit of research online and sitting with certain sellers. So that enters part of the equation. But the theme here is you have to first figure out what type of business is right for you. Then I promise you, it's easy to find and buy it. But right. if you go at it the other way, it's a never-ending maze of businesses listed for sale, and you can't figure any of them out. And buyers don't sit and cross sellers or go to enough meetings or make in enough offers. So they never get out of their own way. And that's why the failure rate is so high.
That's right. And my message would be, so stop coming to your lender saying, I'm looking at a business with this much EBITDA. Listen, there's a lot more to the story if it's a fit. And you could yes. go in with all that EBITDA, which is historical EBITDA. We're not even talking about what's going to happen in the future. Boy, oh boy, that EBITDA could disappear real quick with the wrong owner transitioning in. And we have seen that happen, right?
Oh, absolutely. I'd say, you know, because if a business has historical EBITDA and the wrong person buys it, it's mm-hmm. then going to become hysterical EBITDA. It's just,
yes, I love it.
It's just fucking going to disappear. Pardon my French.
Okay. Oh my gosh, that was it. Perfect. Oof,
goodbye. It's over.
There's historical EBITDA and then there's hysterical.
Hysterical EBITDA. That's and you will become hysterical when the EBITDA goes away. That I promise you.
Oh, you know, if underwriters are listening to this call, they're agreeing with you on that one, Richard.
Yeah, may not publicly, but they'll agree.
All right. Well, what else can we add to this? What are some other good examples that we can share with our listeners? Think of some of your deals that you've done in the past. where maybe it was the wrong business fit for the right, for a buyer who's qualified, but the wrong business fit.
Well, I've seen it, you know, and heard of it mostly in broker days where, you know, from colleagues, the business is being sold and going, seeing them back on the deal board 3 to 6 months or 12 months later. And, you know, oh, it was the wrong fit. They were the wrong person. It almost always comes back to that, barring some catastrophic events.
Yeah.
And I've seen similarly how the right person can absolutely explode a business. I was in Mexico, as you know, a couple of weeks ago and doing this, brought in to do an educational portion for some business buyers that are being underwritten. And there was a perfect example that the people behind all of this, one of them is Iggy Domagalski and his partner, Mike Miller. They started buying smaller businesses. And Iggy and Mike, terrific operators, good marketing people, and really good people. They understand people. They understand the importance of people. And they looked at one of these businesses that had really good margins, but there was a couple of certain fixes to the manufacturing process that were so obvious to Iggy in this case. But even the owners didn't recognize that. They were just almost too close to it or what have you. And they took that business and, you know, I think from they bought it was doing about $600,000 and it did multi-million dollars afterwards. They bought a number of them like this and aggregated them and built them up to over $200 million in revenue because they were the right people. They found these smaller companies, family run. Typically, the owner operator was someone who may have been a technician, a mechanic or what have you, developed this product. But they were stuck in the manufacturing process. They weren't, you know, and they were very good at it, but they weren't marketers. And so they had a defined product, a good product. There was demand in place for the product, a big market, which they haven't eaten. They said, oh, well, you know, in one case they were talking about, well, you know, we have the whole area of one province in Canada covered. We cover that very well. There's nine other provinces and two territories. And they sort of expanded the business dramatically and built it up like just explosive growth. So there's a perfect example that business had been surviving based on, you know, manufacturing and operations, but what it needed was sales and marketing. You have it the other way as well. So, I mean, that was a brilliant example. They ended up exiting and selling out for over $100 million. How's that for a nice story?
That's a story, all right.
Isn't that great? Yeah, that's great.
That's a story. I think of one. I know you don't like restaurants, but some restaurants.
I do. I eat in them all the time.
That's true. But some restaurants do well and are cash flowing and they are successful. Speaking of right fit for a restaurant, obviously you need someone with restaurant experience. Every bank wants that when they come in to buy an established restaurant that's profitable. I have seen sellers who were the chef full time and the owner. And anybody out there that's ever thinking of buying a restaurant, if they sell the recipes, which they do when they exit, they'll leave the recipes behind. That's part of the intangible assets. But underwriters are skeptical because I could have a recipe for my chocolate chip cookies and then give you the recipe to make the same ones, Richard, and they may not taste the same. And I have seen.
Because it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Maybe a little extra something in my chocolate chip cookies. But
no wonder why you're so happy all the time.
Right?
Smart. Very smart.
Just a little green in my cookies. Well, all right. We'll move on. But anyways.
It's staying healthy.
There you go. We had a restaurant.
Vegetables and everything.
That's right. We had a restaurant in town and they made a chicken salad. That I loved. It was their famous chicken salad. And then the original owner, who was the chef full time, sold. And the recipes went with the new owner. But the chicken salad was never freaking the same. And I tried it three times and I gave up. I'm like, it's not even close. And that restaurant closed within a year.
No surprise. Well, happens all the time.
Yeah. Underwriters look at that kind of stuff. You know, even though you think it is the right business fit and you may have the industry experience to buy that restaurant, there's what should have happened was that chef, the original founder, should have trained other chefs you know, for a good amount of time to make sure that they're cooking it the right way. Right. And I've seen deals get done where the underwriters will approve it, but then they want that chef to be a key employee. And they may even offer a structure where you got to make them 2% owners so that chef doesn't go away, because whether the original founder or the trained up chef is gone, that business is going down. So that's
it's going down. And you know what happens? I've seen it happen countless time in the restaurant business. By the way, I like the restaurant business enough that my late partner and I, we had a co-investment in 118 Taco Bells and Applebee's. So I'd like them as a business model, certainly. And so where this goes awry in the restaurant business, the new owner thought to the best of his or her ability that they were following the recipe. That's what they thought. Mm-hmm. But they said, you know what? I don't know why we're buying all this mayonnaise from Cheney Brothers or the other ones. I can get this. I can get 42 gallons where, you know, at Costco.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then find out that, you know, that's different, or the type of chicken they're looking to save a little bit. We have that exact scenario going on around the corner from my house here with an Italian restaurant that was just sold. And I've been ordering pizza there for years, once a week. Chicken and Kalamata olives, and all of a sudden comes in, and I tell my son Jake, who brought it home, I said, something's wrong with this pizza, whatever. I said, there's nowhere near the same amount of chicken. There's like four olives on the thing where it used to be like 30. He said, oh yeah, it got sold because he used to deliver for them. It got sold. He said, how long ago? He said, a week. I said, yeah, they'll be out of business in 3 months. And so this is very important, which brings along the point of when you buy a business, and we could probably have a whole show on this. At the beginning, unless you're an expert in the industry, that's still even if you are an expert in the industry, you don't know that particular business.
There
now, most buyers buy a business in something, an area of they're not familiar. So the first thing you have to do when you take over is nothing. You have to learn the business. I mean, you come in the first day, you don't even know how to turn off the alarm. And so at the beginning, you sit on your hands, you pummel the owner with questions and ask, get feedback from employees, but you observe, you take it all in, you ask questions, you don't make changes. If you're buying a successful business, whatever level that success is, there's a reason for that. So at the beginning, you just don't know enough to change anything. So shut up, sit down on your hands, zip your mouth and observe. And then when you finally get the guts of the business in your belly, then you could start making these changes. But at the beginning, you're not capable. You don't have the know-how to make these changes. So just chill out.
And for anybody listening to the show, if you are an aspiring buyer, you can negotiate the seller staying on for a certain amount of time to show you the ropes, train you up. I just want buyers to, recognize a lot of what we're sharing is red flags, but we will help you. Richard and I will help you understand that you can negotiate the seller to stay on, to show you the ropes and how are things done.
Yes.
And if they're selling a business and they want to get the hell out of there in 2 weeks, I don't know if I like that.
No, I agree with you. That transitional period is critically important. The way you want to have the longest period possible that makes sense, and it should be free training as long as it's not abusive. They're not staying on board for a year for free, but certainly a month or two. And if you feel that whenever you feel at a certain point, if it happens during that agreed upon transition period that you're good and you don't need them, then throw them out. That's great. Sometimes they're more of a pain in the ass than anything else. But at the beginning, I mean, you need them for the transition and just to help you navigate your way initially. And sometimes it's also required to provide a level of comfort to the employees or the suppliers or the customers.
Yeah.
So you do that in a good, meaningful way. But you must have them on board initially, just even if you're bouncing stuff of them. And if they're getting in the way, you could always tell them, listen, don't come in. I'll call you if I have any questions, that type of thing. But understand that it's this hump of transition that's really important. You don't know it all.
That's
and so
right.
Don't think that you do. You're not going to make your mark on the business until you know the business and have the guts of the business in your belly.
So back to if the business is the right fit for you. And we were talking about restaurants just a bit ago. I got another one. It was an Italian restaurant. And the owner was semi-absentee, meaning, one foot out the door. The team of people are running the restaurant successfully, Richard. And I learned a lesson from an underwriter because she came back to me explaining that, what are we going to do with the new owner? Can the new owner sing? I'm like, can the new one?
Like, yeah. So they could have hired you. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay.
I like where this is going. Go ahead.
She studied reviews on the business, which I learned this years ago. And she taught me this and it was an eye opener. And for any business buyers doing their due diligence, we should do a show on Google reviews of businesses. The Google reviews and other platform reviews of the restaurant talked about the original founder who is now selling, always singing in the restaurant to the patrons, table to table, an Italian restaurant, and singing, you know, old crooner songs. She's like, who's going to replace him?
You.
Right? No,
how wild is that? That what I find spectacular in all of this is that the underwriter, not the buyer, uncovered this.
There you go.
I mean, that's just crappy due diligence on the part of the buyer, because all they had, it shows you that the buyer did not go for dinner at the restaurant.
Focusing on EBITDA, probably.
Yeah, hysterical EBITDA. Yeah.
Right. Oh,
so imagine doing your due diligence on a restaurant and not going there to eat. When I used to be in the lower end brokerage business, I never took an engagement when I first met the seller. I always wanted to learn more about the business, about them, that I like them, that I trust them. I'm very diligent about taking on, because I never want to represent a business that I'm not comfortable in selling, of course. But I always did two things. If you know, we had a meeting, but before I even had the meeting, I went to the restaurant, I went to the bathroom.
If
the bathroom was dirty, I canceled my appointment. I never met them.
I like that idea.
And the other thing that I did is after I met them, then I went and had dinner there. And sometimes I did it before, but always after. And just to measure the caliber of the food and what have you, the service, see if there's any pain points. But it shows you this buyer, how ridiculous it is that this buyer was moving forward on a transaction and obviously never even ate at the restaurant.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we made this great dog food, but the dogs won't eat it.
Well, guess what? The bank declined the deal. They weren't comfortable enough. And the buyer still wanted to move forward. And the reviews were all, we love this owner. We love this restaurant. I mean, I'd love it too if I had, you know, an old crooner singing me a song over my lasagna.
Yeah, know? Well, the food might not have been that great, but it was the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was the intangible asset that was no longer going to be there.
Intangible and immeasurable. Absolutely. He's a great example.
Yeah. But let's do that. I see Sia put a note up. Let's do an episode on Google reviews, because that's another take for business buyers. You can see a business is getting ready for sale when all of a sudden there's a ton of Google reviews and they're all 5-star in the last 6 months.
Yes. 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 You have that. And it's that, and that's the key thing to look at. We could have another show on that, is the timing of these. When did they happen recently? The other thing to look for in the Google reviews, and we're off subject a little bit, is the intermittent period between reviews. Cause you can go back for a certain period in time, not just to look to see what's recent, but going back further and see, you know, how frequently people are writing reviews altogether, which could tell you a lot about whether or not these are realistic or not realistic, and what type of engagement does the business have with a negative review. Like, who cares about the positive ones? Yeah. It's you want to see how they handled the negative ones. Because sometimes you see very combative staff and ownership, which is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. I recently put up a post last week suggesting to everyone to do a review of your competitor. If you're a small business owner, look at your competitor reviews. So I did one, a review of my competitor in my space. And it was clear, Richard, that he was paying to get 5-star reviews. Very in a thoughtful. Similar position, doing SBA brokering of loans. And every 3 hours, every day for 3 months straight, it was like a 90-day period, constant 5-star reviews with great job, great owner, got to do business with him. And then after the 90 days, crickets.
Yep.
And I dug a little bit deeper, and yes, there are firms out there, and they're probably overseas or what have you, but you can pay as a small business owner to have your business lifted up with all those reviews.
Yep.
It made me sick, because there is no way that this one little one man broker with maybe some assist, you know, people assisting him could have closed that many loans every 3 hours for 90 days straight.
Yeah, really. It's nonsense. And you catch, and I don't think people are really that dumb. You know, they catch on to it as well. There was a stat, there's a software that's being developed right now that's going to be able to filter it. The goal of it is to filter through all of the false reviews, whether it be on Amazon, Google reviews, et cetera, because a study was done. I read this not long ago, and they said 87% of the reviews that are online are BS. 87%. And I would believe it. Yeah. And I would believe it. And what's going to happen because of that is people are going to start paying far less attention to reviews, as they started years ago to start paying attention to some testimonials where they mark Bob J, Wichita, Kansas. Well, who is this? Make him real, right? Show a right. picture of him, show a picture of his business, make Bob legit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the understanding reviews and looking for the inconsistencies in reviews is equally important as the task of looking at reviews themselves.
That's right.
Yep. I think we have some questions, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it's time to take them in. We're at the half hour mark. So let's put up a question or two. See you in the background here. What you got for us?
Here we go.
What key factors or criteria should individuals consider when determining the right type of business for them?
You want to take a stab at it?
Yeah. Well, I always request to see the most recent professional resume, but I also like to ask questions as well of aspiring small business buyers, hobbies, interests. Let's be real. Some of us are in our later years, and a lot of us are buying these businesses because they're absentee owned. A job that I had in the early 90s, that experience may qualify me for a business I want to buy today. So my resume may be recent because if I go back 30 years, Richard, with my resume, it's going to be a few pages long. Right. So I like to, as you were saying, Richard, you know, what is your interest? You know, what are you good at? You were saying that earlier in the show. Yes. So I'll yield the mic and you add to that.
Well, I think, you know, And I go a step further saying, what are you great at?
Yeah.
Because interest, and we can talk separately related to turning hobbies into a business, which is generally a terrible idea, but it's really what you're great at. So to me, when you look at the factors, you have the financial factors of how much you're prepared to invest, what you need back from the business, what the business does every day, certain considerations. For example, if you're someone who has a young family, you don't want to be working on a business that, you know, has that you have to work every weekend or evenings, or if there's travel involved. So you have these type of considerations, other considerations related to your family members, because even though you may be buying the business, they're in this process too, and you have to make sure that they're on board. So that's important criteria. But at the top of the list is, getting back to what we talked about right at the beginning of the show, is the number one important factor is identifying your number one skill set. And I've said this in almost the same words, can't emphasize that enough. That's the most important factor. What is your number one skill set? Marry that to the right business. And then you have the additional criteria of ones we just talked about, family, what other considerations, what growth potential that you want from the business, whether you want a business with recurring revenue, if you want a business that has a unique product or sells to a particular industry. Those are all important criteria, but your criteria should be a few bullet points. You know, I have 5 golden rules that I look for in a business, but should be no more than that, which is sales and marketing driven, demand in place, high margins, exclusively territory, and doesn't compete on price. So you want to keep those really tight. But there's one that's got to be at the top of the list, which is skills.
And that's why I believe seasoned corporate employees generally have a lot of those skill sets.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I agree. Next question. Here we go. How can they assess whether a particular business aligns with their skills, interests, and long-term goals? You know, the resume for one is, and as a business acquisition loan consultant, I have sent buyers back to the resume table to tweak things, because in conversation, I know that they have skills to align with the business, but it's not necessarily written in the resume as it should be. So yes, number one, that resume and a lot of conversation with the buyer for me to understand their character and their skills. The underwriter as well, Richard, will interview the buyer before final credit decision. And a lot can be determined if that resume is fluff, because let's
there's a lot of those.
Oh yeah. People have, you know, I had friends back in the day that would put fluff on their resume and get hired and big paying jobs, and they didn't know what the hell they were doing.
And didn't last long. And you know what? I can't say that I agree with it, but that's okay if you're going to work for someone. You certainly don't want to do that when it's on your nickel and you're the business. You know, when Jody asked this question, so we talk about business aligns with their skills, interests, and long-term goals. The first thing Jody wanted is, you know, get a very good understanding of what the owner does every day. And you want to make sure, because if you're going to be replacing that skill set, most importantly, if their particular skill set is what drives the revenue and profits of the business, you have to understand what they do every day and make sure, number one, that aligns with you. Number two, if it's a common type business, for example, you know, commercial landscaping or distribution company or durable medical equipment company. When I say, you know, common, more generic, that these type of businesses exist, and from one business to the other, a lot of it is the same. You should speak to owners in the same type of business. Now, if you speak to owners in the same type of business, don't speak to competitors. Go outside the territory and never disclose the type of business that you're looking at, but you want to speak to owners of like businesses and understand what do they do every day, because the seller of the business may be not telling you the exact truth of what they do every day, because remember, they want to sell you the business. So by getting perspective from others in the industry of what drives their particular business will give you some terrific insight. As far as your interests are concerned and long-term goals, I'm going to talk about the long-term goals first, whether you have to define what those are. I mean, I can't, Deb can't, what your long-term goal, whether it's growth or stability. I personally believe in the acquisition of a business that growth is sexy, but stability is valuable. Mm-hmm. And so you want something that's stable. But if you want something that has long-term growth goals, long-term growth, for example, you want to make sure that the industry, the business is poised to do that with you at the helm.
Yeah.
As far as the interests are concerned, I think this comes into play related to people's passions or whatever. And I think I'm going to have to expand on this, but I think passions are overrated as it comes to businesses, because you typically, if you focus on, oh, I got to buy a business that I'm passionate about. Well, you know what? If it's a shit business, you're going to lose your passion pretty quickly. So your passion really comes in time, meaning you buy a business, you're operating at will. You don't have to work for someone else or listen to some boss's nonsense. You're helping, you know, you're empowering employees. You're seeing some growth opportunities. You're excited about getting up every day. There's an economic benefit, and your passion happens by default. Mm-hmm. And so I think the hierarchy of your question is, you know, making sure it aligns with your skills and your long-term goals, number two. And the interests, I think, are further behind, as long as you define certain things that you won't do. Like you won't be in certain industries, or you want to be in something related to children or healthcare. I get that, but making sure you whittle that down so it becomes very granular to your skill set. And those are a few ways you can go about doing it.
So what are your thoughts? Because this is a common question that I receive from buyers, searchers out there. Just like SBA qualified is pasted on every listing out there, and we know it's true and accurate. Another marketed terminology is absentee owned, quote unquote, on every business listing. So buyers will ask me, how do I know it's absentee owned? How do you verify that in your due diligence?
Well, the first thing is, when absentee owned businesses usually equal absentee profits. And even if you're buying an absentee business, if you are the new owner, you have to learn that business.
Right.
Because if you have a manager, let's say, Deb, you own a business, you own a distribution company, you're working 4 hours a week or 22, anything that could be considered absentee, you have a terrific manager in place and it's humming along great for you. But at the beginning, you ran that business, and then you ultimately decided to extract yourself a little bit and put in a manager. Now, if that manager quits, gets hit by a Pepsi Cola truck, or anything happens, the next day you go back in, you work 40 hours a week, and you find a replacement manager. That's the scenario, right?
Yeah.
However, Now you take that same situation where there's manner in place and Deb is selling her distribution business and I want to go buy that business. Mm-hmm. And we agree it's absentee and the manager is Jody and she's doing a great job. And I buy the business, okay? And Jody's running it for 3 months and I'm just collecting some paychecks and checking in with her periodically. And then God forbid something happens to Jody or she quits or she goes to a competitor or she gets hit by the same Pepsi truck as Deb's manager got hit by. Well, now what do I do? I don't even know how the hell to run the business. I don't even know how it operates, what type of manager to hire. I don't even know where to start. Mm-hmm. And so if absentee run businesses sound wonderful, and yes, you can figure out if it's true or not by some real good questions. However, you have to understand, if you're going to buy an absentee run business, the first thing you got to do is learn the business.
Thank you. And if you're doing bank financing backed by the SBA, there is two words that mean everything to the transaction.
What, owner operator?
Okay, personal guarantee.
Yeah, okay, yeah, okay. That's right.
And there's a lot of influence out there online by some folks that are in this space talking about buying boring businesses because they're absentee owned or they're just old.
It's stagnant. It's nonsense. I mean, yes, it's attractive. I like bland, boring, unsexy businesses. Yes, but this concept of buying a boring business, and I know who you're talking about specifically, mm-hmm. with this idea that anybody can run a boring business. It's not true. It's not true. My grandson, Grayson, who's 6 months old, can't run the business. And I'll line up 10,000 people that have good jobs that can't run the business. And so if you have no operational skills, the idea of buying a business, then you're not going to get involved in doing it. You know what? Might as well light your money on fire. It's not going to work until you learn the business. Yes, you can move towards getting a manager in place. And that's ultimate because then it becomes more sellable. But the new owner coming in has to have operational experience. If not, they're putting themselves in a horribly vulnerable position if anything changes in the business. Imagine you have a full-time job and you have three laundromats or whatever, some of those examples mm-hmm. I know that one individual you're talking about. You have three mm-hmm. laundromats and they're run by a manager and they quit. What are you going to stop working? No. You're going to lose. If you do that, you'll lose your job and the business.
And sadly, what I'm seeing is that same person that talks about buying boring businesses is telling you to do it without SBA financing and try to cash in whatever cash you have and just buy it all or do 100% financing with the seller. You're putting yourself in a terrible, terrible position. Due diligence by a bank on those three laundromats that said, you know, boring, absentee owned, manager quits. You're working full time thinking you got an absentee business. So, and I'm going to make all this money and diversify my income. It's going to be a shit show when that manager leaves.
Oh, not absolutely. And very often it's a shit show while they're there taking the money. I mean, I've doing this for over three decades and we said from the onset, buying an absentee operated business is typically means absentee profits. It just does not materialize like you had hoped or what was represented unless you understand the business. So, some of these information sources is, you know, they're just taking advantage of very vulnerable people who have hopes and dreams and aspirations and would love to get into a side hustle or additional income, to generate some additional income. But you know what? Here's what it comes down to. Use your common sense. Even though we know that common sense isn't very common, use some goddamn common sense and think about it. Because if that business is absentee run and it's so terrific and the owner spends no time doing it, unless they're dying, why are they selling it?
Why the hell are they selling it then? Thank you.
Because if I had a bunch of those, I wouldn't be selling them.
Right. Thank you. That's a great way to end the show. Damn it.
Okay. Deb, since your sign is down, I will tell you, go with God. Have yourself a terrific week. As always, it's wonderful. Oh, wonderful to spend time with you.
This was great. I love talking with you. I learned so much from you and I know our listeners do as well. I thank you everyone who stopped by today. We're going to do this again next week. And if anyone out there has ideas for episode topics, feel free, reach out to Richard or myself. Our information is there up on the screen. We'd love to hear what topics you'd like us to talk about. But I think we need to do a Google review episode. That would be fun.
You know, we should probably do a little bit of research and bring some up, you know, live on screen or some screenshots to show ones that we know for sure are full of shit. And, you know, and yet they come across so terrific. You know what? It's like the, you know, it reminds me of the business for sale ads. Right. Yeah. And I've told people this for years. You go online to one of the business for sale websites, you see some, oh, it sounds so terrific, including or not including what you mentioned about absentee owner business. But yeah, there's a great write up. It sounds terrific. And then you find out it's like a pile of garbage.
Yeah.
And I like to tell people, I said, you know, if I went on to personal ad app, the apps or websites, mm-hmm, I said, I could make myself sound like Tom Cruise.
I know.
You know, instead, you get a short, balding guy sitting in South Florida, and, yeah, and you expecting Tom Cruise to walk through the door. Sorry, oh, not happening.
Yeah, the competitor that we talked about earlier that I did a review on, I'm in Wisconsin, okay, and so is the competitor. And there's a radio station that's real popular in the Milwaukee market, and they do a weekly segment. We're in Wisconsin. And it's called Dairyland Dumbasses. So I call you're a Dairyland Dumbass because there's no way in hell you can have that many 5-star reviews. Yeah. Anyways, so.
Well, you can have that many 5-star reviews. It is possible in on a limited basis.
Right.
And timing that makes sense. If he had those from 12 people over the course of the last year, it's a lot more believable than every 90 minutes.
Exactly. Was
wow.
Crazy.
Crazy. So
we'll end the show on that note, ladies and gentlemen. And this is Richard Parker and Deb Curtis, your co-hosts. We love talking business, buying banter, the no BS kind. So next week, Thursday, we're back at it, 2 p.m. Eastern. Thank you for stopping by, and we'll see you next time. Bye, Richard.
Bye, Deb. See you soon.
All right.